Finally today, to the thoughts of a seasoned observer of culture, change and people, Sir Ferdinand Mount, one of Britain's finest political and literary writers. And in the light of the huge shocks delivered by the Brexit vote, it makes his new collection of essays, in which he reflects on the meaning of Englishness, even more inviting. The result's a book titled English Voices, Lives, Landscapes, Laments. And of course, it was compiled before he could have heard the remarkable speeches like the one delivered this week to his original home, the Tory Party conference, by the new UK leader, Theresa May, in which she argued the Conservatives were now the party of the workers, of public servants, and the party of the NHS. Bob Hawke, one of Australia's most cherished former prime ministers, said in June this year, "It's the first time since the Second World War when there's not one outstanding leader in the world." Well, agree or not, today's statesmen and women are for the most part a different bunch to the characters of last century. And exploring these temperamental similarities and differences interests Ferdinand Mount immensely. I thought we'd focus today on one particular section of his work, Our Statesmen, his words, covering political figures like Churchill, Harold Macmillan and Margaret Thatcher, whom he advised in the early 1980s. I managed to capture some time with him earlier this week to welcome him to Saturday Extra.
Good morning, Geraldine.
Now, what do you think about that verdict of our former Prime Minister Bob Hawke?
I think that's, with respect to the great Bob Hawke, I think that's what retired Prime Ministers,
tend to
especially
say.
Long retired Prime Ministers, often tend to say. And I don't think it's true about today's leaders. I think Angela Merkel is a remarkable leader of Germany. I think Vladimir Putin, whatever you may think of him, and I think of him with great alarm, but he's certainly a formidable character. And I don't think President Obama's completely without qualities. So I don't think that's true. But I think also, if you go back to the past leaders, the people I've been writing about in the Our Statesmen section in the book, I mean, you have to remember what rackety characters many of them were. They were all tremendous adulterers, except, of course, Mrs. Thatcher, and they were, large number of them were drunk half the time, Churchill not least. Asquith was known as Old Squiffy because he could scarcely stand up in the House of Commons some evenings. And a lot of them made terrible mistakes. So I think the contrast is an unfair one to the leaders of the present.
I must say, you say you used to be pitiless about the inadequacy of your masters. And over the years, you've become, well, what have you become over the years? Because you certainly, I think you have quite a bit of pity for some of these people.
Yes, I think I have become more charitable as I've got older. And I do think that a lot of them made the best of a very poor hand, and that is what the hand that you normally tend to get dealt when you reach supreme office. Look at Mrs. Theresa May, who suddenly catapulted into number 10 and has got appallingly difficult things to deal with. So, you know, the ones who were remembered with admiration squeaked through, but a lot of them had a very, very difficult time, particularly in Britain, I think less so in Australia, because Britain was coming down from the heights of a great empire and in the process had to fight two crippling world wars, both of which left her bankrupt. So they had a tough old hand to play.
There is a lovely line, you don't use it, but I've never forgotten it, of John Cleese saying to somebody, "You have absolutely no idea how difficult it is to be English." Which was a very English remark. But is that your verdict when you stand back and look at it?
Well, I think one of the things that's difficult to be English is that the meaning of being English keeps on changing. I mean, if you take the three, what I call the three P's, which are supposed to be characteristic of Englishness, peacefulness, piety, and phlegm, good old British phlegm, all of them, you know, are just passing moods. After all, several centuries we used to cut kings' heads off and lead rebellions in support of exiled dynasties. In the Regency, the standard of sexual morality makes today look like absolute Puritanism. And of course, today, as we have seen, the most extraordinary changes in being English. The stiff upper lip crumbled terminally at the funeral of Princess Diana, and of course that's one of the things, I think, that makes it difficult, as it were, for the people of the sort of character that John Cleese is playing to be English, because the manners and the mores of the country are in constant evolution.
Which, of course, makes it an extremely durable country, I suppose. And in a way, that's what I get from reading these essays of yours. But I wonder what you have decided. What makes a statesman or stateswoman? Are there particular qualities, given that you've devoted a whole section to it, that differentiate them from other politicians or public figures?
I think two things, above all, are physical stamina and luck. Physical stamina is absolutely indispensable. Looking back, I don't know, as far as Gladstone's day, is how little sleep they all got by on and how grueling the tensions were. I mean, people say that politics is 24/7 these days. Well, in a sense, it always was. And, the House of Commons, for example, used to sit till 4 in the morning regularly throughout the great crises of our history. So you have to be tough and you have to be lucky. You have to come in at the right time or happen to be around at the right time. I mean, 6 months ago, nobody would have thought for a second that Theresa May was going to be the next Prime Minister. I would think she would have been about fifth or sixth in the betting for the next Tory leader. So chance plays a huge part.
Mm. Look, you do say of the British statesmen, mostly of the last century, you say what bounders and bon viveurs most of them were, but they also did use the English language incredibly well, all of them. And you do, one of the judgments you make, it's a sort of a paean of praise to the English language. Why did you believe this came to be so important?
Well, I think there are two things that, all the things that change about Englishness over the centuries, I think that two things that stay absolutely at the heart of it are the common law and the English language. And I think I'd say that that's probably true of Australia too, is that the tradition of the common law and the richness and the freedom of the English language are the two things that make us, Britain and Australia are very different in many ways, but those two things we both have. And
whereas you made the point, I just got to interrupt, you said on the continent, a lot of in Europe, the elites continue to speak Latin by contrast with the English.
Exactly, that everything was written in English all through the old and Saxon period, and everyone spoke English, the elite and imposed Norman French for a time, but that didn't last. The English language sort of surged back through, and it remains fantastically rich and has, in the last 20, 30 years, become the lingua franca, to use a non-English phrase, of the entire globe, because it is so rich and so flexible.
Look, probably the best known of the statesmen who embodies both this bon viveur and the literateur is Churchill. And it's very interesting the way you write about Churchill, because you say that actually it wasn't so much an excess about him, although, my goodness, you do point out how self-aggrandizing he was and self-dramatizing he was immediately after the Great War. And obviously, Australians listening know about him and Gallipoli and so on. It was a poverty of imagination, actually, that he couldn't, in his strategizing, he couldn't imagine, in a way, how bad things could get. And this did lead to the Dardanelles.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, the piece that I've written in this collection is about Churchill at Gallipoli, and I wrote it partly because my grandfather was killed at Gallipoli, leaving my mother, the youngest of her family, aged 2, and 5 siblings older, and so my grandmother couldn't bear to have the name Churchill mentioned in her hearing. Mm. But, I mean, that is only one part of Churchill's, lack of imagination, that he charged on, and sometimes he was right and quite often he was wrong. I mean, he was very wrong about India, for example, and people have often thought that the feeling against Indian independence continued in Britain long into the 30s and indeed after the war. It was really only a few dinosaurs like Churchill who hadn't realized that the game was up and that the Indians had earned their independence by fighting in the First World War, and that it was an inevitable and just thing to happen. So it is that kind of denseness combined with that fantastic energy which kept him going, and which finally, in 1940, proved to be exactly what was needed.
And look, because we've got to get through a couple of more special people, you do make the point that he actually did see the verdict, eventually, of large wars. He confronted large wars and the fact that you would have big numbers of dead and that there was no other way around it. And I suppose you do comment on the sort of dramatic changes of attitudes to war. But I have to ask you about Margaret Thatcher, for whom you worked, the subject, of course, of a crop of biographies that inevitably came out soon after such a notable figure died. And it's very interesting how you write about her disruptive style, disruptive being the word of the moment, that actually you quote a businessman who dealt with her and wrote to her, "You break every rule of good man management. You bully your weaker colleagues. You criticise them in front of each other and in front of their officials. They can't answer back without appearing disrespectful to a woman and a prime minister. You abuse that situation. You give little praise or credit, and you're too ready to blame others when things go wrong." So was she...
That's my old friend and in fact predecessor in the job I had, John Hoskins. I must say, it's amazing. I admire his courage.
Indeed,
in
so.
she was
a poor chair, but it's because she broke the mould of being a chair of an English cabinet.
Yes, because the mould in theory is that the, as it is in cabinet systems everywhere, that the prime minister is just a chairman who sort of makes sure that the agenda is properly put together and a decent conclusion is reached. But actually, most successful prime ministers have not been chairpersons like that. They've been dynamic people who insisted on getting their own way, and she just did it in a more forceful and annoying way. But I mean, she, you know, Lloyd George and Churchill and so on certainly would have insisted that they got their way. But I mean, just speaking as a sort of underling at the time, it was a blood sport to watch because these important men in suits came in and regularly got a complete roasting.
Did she like doing that?
Well, there must have been a part of her which quite enjoyed it, don't you think? I mean, you wouldn't do it day in and day out if it was really painful to you.
You said she loathed that sort of that style of calming everything down and putting a good face on it that, say, Harold Macmillan did, you know, which was the hallmark of good Tory behaviour.
Yeah, well, and of course the trouble with that calming down mode is that nothing much happens. And if you think that quite a lot of things need to happen, then you have to be disruptive in that way.
Look, finally, I'm going to ask you then about, which you haven't written about, clearly it was too recent, about Brexit, you've written quite a lot. I mean, where do you place the decisions that are coming with regard to Brexit in this overall list?
Well, they are incredibly difficult, and I think this is, the next 5 years are going to be very, very difficult, a difficult series of decisions and manoeuvres. And I think that most people who voted Leave would agree with that. I mean, to be fair to them, and I mean, I voted Remain, but to be fair to the Leavers, the better of them said, you know, this is a brave and tough decision that we want you to take. And my God, it is, because you have to reconcile irreconcilable things if you want to have any continuing relationship with the European Union, that is control of migration and access to the free market. So I'm sure there are a lot of people saying we'll muddle through, but it doesn't look very promising at the moment.
Okay. Well, look, thank you very much. As you say, that the art of biography is very revered. In France, it's regarded as sort of nothing more than higher gossip, but you've certainly entertained us with your various biographies in this book, and I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Geraldine. Thank you very much indeed.